It's it is always nice to be back here, and you know, it is, since you are all friends of the Institute, it's maybe worth remarking.
Difficult to hear you.
Okay, let's see if we can work on that. That says green. I don't do anything. I just talk louder. Okay. So, it's worth thinking a little bit about what this Institute has done for so many of us before we start with the talk. When I was here, there were, I guess, about 10 postdocs. There are nearly half again, or twice as many by now. And it was a remarkable time. We were very privileged young men and women. We were a bit spoiled. We had access to fabulous mentors, a stream of visitors that we couldn't imagine. And we learned a lot about being scientists, about being theoretical physicists, and what that meant. It's not just the problems you work on. It's theoretical physics, maybe more than most disciplines, has a culture to it, to which David alluded obliquely. The tools that we bring, but also the intellectual style and the sense of shared searching for something, that's really very important. And this place has always, I think, been characteristic of that, has always sort of harbored and nurtured that sense of community among theoretical physicists and transmitted it to generation now after generation. But, you know, if I was a postdoc 20 plus years ago, by now, people who I see as students, in fact, one of my students was a postdoc here, so I guess that calibrates things. So this is a fabulous place, and always produces warm feelings to come back. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your for the invitation, and to all of you for your support of the institution. What I want to do today is to tell you about a few of the many incredibly beautiful phenomena that you see in the living world. And I'm going to choose phenomena that, as a physicist, have some particular resonance. There's something about them that, as we look at them, we can sort of get a glimpse of those principles that David was referring to that we all hope is underneath all this great complexity. Now, of course, we could be wrong, which is why this is fun. If it was guaranteed that if you work on this problem and you work out the details and you find the answer and then that's how it all works, then it wouldn't be quite so much fun. The fact that the phenomena of life present you with this incredible variety of things, they're unimaginably complicated, and you sort of have this feeling that, like the rest of the physical universe, it ought to be possible to wrestle those phenomena to the ground and give a concise mathematical description, that there's a risk that we're just not up to that task. And that's why it's exciting. So I'm going to take you through a few examples where I hope I can give you the sense of what we're looking for. And it's a small group, so please interrupt. And we'll see how it goes. I was looking for, they say it's a chalk talk, so, you know, I felt I should give you the chalk, but I was looking for a photograph that I could use to start the talk, but I really couldn't find one, because to really have the visual experience, you kind of have to do it yourself. So let me describe something to you. And I hope that at some point you'll all have a chance to do it. It doesn't need any special equipment. Ideally, you should get a praying mantis. It really works well with a praying mantis. It works pretty well with other insects, too. With a praying mantis, it's really compelling. So you have this praying mantis sitting there, and you look into its eyes. And what you see is a pupil that looks just like our pupil, you know, the black spot in the center of your eye. And what's really amazing is that the praying mantis is sitting there, and you go to one side, and the pupil seems to go around to follow you. And then you go to the other side, and the pupil moves around to follow you. It's beautiful. Okay? Now, a praying mantis's eye is maybe about that big across. The most, you get a nice big one. The pupil is a very small spot. And it seems to follow you wherever you go if you're looking at it. Some of you may know that insects can't actually move their eyes. So it is certainly not the case that the praying mantis is looking at you and following you as you move. Okay. Seems that way, but that's not what's happened. So suppose we could make a slice through the head of an insect. So you're looking from over here. What you'd see and if you want to make this clear, actually, a praying mantis is a poor choice. A fly is actually a better choice, just your common housefly. You look closely at a common housefly, and you look down on the fly's head, you'll see lots of little pieces in the fly's eye. This is pretty easy to get a photograph of, but I didn't bring one. And what you're looking at is a collection of lenses. Every one of these little objects, which is, let's see, maybe a 30th of an inch across or so, is a separate lens. Now, in our eye, of course, we have one big lens, and there's something over here. It projects onto your retina here, and there's a cell sitting here that detects the light. Not unlike the way one pixel in your digital camera would detect the light. Unlike your digital camera, there's a lot of processing circuitry that's sitting in the chip, as it were, and the signals are then sent out of the eye to your brain. And of course, when you're looking in the other direction, there's another cell over here. And so all of the cells in your retina are looking out through the same lens. If you're an insect, it's a little different. Every cell, almost, it's a physicist approximation, every cell has its own private lens. And so when the insect is looking in this direction, it's using this cell, just as we might use this cell to look in that direction. But instead of all the cells looking through one big lens, they all look through their own small lenses. And these are actually quite a little marvel of optical design. And many insects use all sorts of wonderful physics tricks to improve their vision. Things that, you know, we all learned about in our electricity and magnetism courses and forgot about. But in fact, nature didn't forget about them. So there's one lovely one. Maybe you all know about optical waveguides, right, or optical fiber. So how do you make optical fiber? This is coursing through the ground all over America. Several companies went bankrupt. Wiring up the entire country with optical fiber. Perhaps you have optical fiber that brings your video and internet to your house. But the way optical fiber works is that you can sort of trap, you know, normally you think that when you shine a light, right, the light goes everywhere. But if you shine the light down a material and you surround the material with something else that has different optical properties, then the light essentially can be trapped inside the little tube. Now it turns out that happens a little bit in our retina, but it happens a lot in insect retinas, in insect eyes, because the optical properties of the cells that actually absorb the light and create the electrical signal that eventually passes to the insect's brain are very different than the optical properties of the stuff that surrounds them. And so sitting in the eyes of all the insects flying around, there is the equivalent of this technology that emerged 20 or 30 years ago in man-made engineered systems. If you go back to those problem sets that we all had to do as graduate students in physics, you will find out that when light propagates in a waveguide, most of the energy of the light is sitting in the middle, but a little bit of it leaks out. And of course, if all of it leaked out, then it wouldn't be a waveguide. It wouldn't be an optical fiber anymore, right? So you don't want it to go too far. But since some of the light is sitting outside, there's this interesting thing that if you were to put something right here that absorbed light, so something black, you would suck energy out, you'd suck energy from the light beam that was propagating through the core. Now, why am I telling you all this? So we can stop down our pupil, right? Or if you're a photographer, you know about changing your aperture, right? Lights get bright, you close the aperture down. Now, if you're an insect, again, take some time to actually look at an insect, you'll find that his eyes go all the way over his head. So when he's flying, he can be sure that one of these little pixels of his camera is pointed straight at the sun. Now, you know that if you look up at the sun, your pupil stops down immediately. Where's the pupil? How's he going to solve that problem? There's no pupil. It's right here. What happens when the lights get too bright is that the cells that are around the cell that actually absorbs light, that does the business of detecting the light, they have these little black granules, and they move the granules closer so that they feel some of that evanescent wave that's propagating in the outer part of this optical fiber and suck the light away. And that means that they can stop down their pupil in this part of their eye, but not in this part of their eye. It's quite lovely. So imagine if you had sunglasses that were sort of adjustable so that, you know, in the part where it was really bright, it got darker, and then, you know, when you look down, it doesn't look dark, right? Because they're, be pretty clever, right? So, but what does this have to do with that experience of looking into the praying mantis's eye? Well, remember that this isn't just a fancy optical instrument. This is an eye. Eventually, you have to absorb the light. You have to measure that the light arrived, just like in your camera. So when the light gets focused through this lens onto this little fiber, which contains the cell that responds to light, it gets absorbed. But the whole point of having a lens is that it only looks in this direction, so that this cell doesn't see things that are coming from here. So if you look at this point, and you look from this direction, the light would just sort of bounce off. But if you look directly onto this axis, straight through the lens, center of the lens, and you look, as it were, into the cell that's actually going to absorb the light, no light comes back to you. It all gets absorbed. And you see a black spot. But of course, if you were looking over here and you looked exactly on this axis, you would also see a black spot. That's the pupil that you see when you look into the praying mantis's eye. And the reason that it moves is that it's always on the axis that you're looking. Okay? Now, take a moment the next time you see a praying mantis. It's beautiful physics. I mean, it's great. Now, you might ask, well, okay, that's interesting. And actually, if you look at different insects, they use all sorts of different tricks. So for example, there's another problem, right? When we build optical instruments, we use mirrors. Mirrors have metallic coatings to reflect the light. You may notice that biology can do many remarkable things, but you haven't seen any creatures secrete metallic coatings, right? It doesn't seem to happen. I don't know why, but it doesn't happen. They secrete all sorts of weird things, but no metallic coatings. So you might guess that at some point in the course of building optical instruments, you would be stymied by the fact that you can't make a mirror because you don't have any metal. But you may remember that light is a wave, and the statement that something is a mirror has to do with that wave bouncing back at you. And waves can scatter off of things. And you know that if they scatter, they often have a little phase shift as they scatter. So you have a white wave, and it hits something. This is the wave going this way. Well, when it comes back, it might be that the wave that gets launched back is a little bit shifted. And you know that if it got shifted so much that the peaks lined up with the troughs, you wouldn't see anything at all because the peaks and troughs would cancel out. That's called destructive interference. And it's easy to do with water waves in your bathtub, right? Launch two waves, you know, stick your finger in the bathtub over here, wiggle it up and down, there's a wave that goes out, stick your finger in the bathtub over here, up and down, there's a wave that goes out, and you notice that where they come together, they make this complicated interference pattern. So you can make waves disappear by giving them the right phase shift, as this is called, or you can also get different phase shifts. Well, you can get this, and you say, well, you know, a metal is just something that has the right phase shift. That's why things bounce back at you. That's what a mirror does. But somehow I don't have those components available to me. I can't quite get the right phase shift just by painting things with a metal surface. So what do I do? Well, I could make a stack of things. And if this wave gets launched back, and then this wave gets launched back, and this wave gets launched back, and the spacing between the elements of this stack are related to the wavelength of the wave, I can do almost anything I want by stacking things up in just the right way. And in fact, that trick for building the equivalent of mirrors is used in butterfly eyes. And it's also used, of course, in butterfly wings. That's why, remember, if you use this trick, then it only works when this distance is related to the wavelength of the light. If I change the color of the light, I change the wavelength, and what was a reflecting surface is now a transmitting surface or an absorbing surface. And so I can see the surface look different, the same surface, same structure, look completely different with different colors. And these colors are very, very sharply defined because they depend very critically on this relationship between the spacing and the wavelength. And that's why, for example, you get incredibly vivid colors for tropical fish and things like this, because they use this mechanism rather than painting themselves with colored pigments the way a plant does. Yeah?
I'm just curious, I don't want to interrupt, but the...
It's not clear what I'm planning on doing, okay, so okay. You're not interrupting.
You know when the dusk and dawn for human
yes.
beings, guys, and that our cones and our rods
yes.
are most open, and it's called, it started with a P, Purjanki or something?
Oh, yeah, okay, go on,
so
yes.
it's the most brilliant time to look at anything, because again...
Oh, because you have this moment where both your rods and cones are working.
That's
yes.
right.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I was just curious within all of this.
So, insects, so let's be sure everybody remembers the relevant fact. So our retina has four different kinds of cells that absorb light. One are rods, and those are the ones we use for our night vision. And they don't provide us with any color information because there's only one kind. Then there are the cones, which we use during daytime or when the lights are on. And there are three of those. And just like the R, G, and B on your video screen, they give you three channels, and thus you can get color information. By the way, what this means is that really at night, when it's really dark out, you shouldn't see any color at all. This is another experiment you should do. It's not so easy to achieve that. Because when you're looking at a tree, you know that the leaves are green. And it doesn't matter whether you have any data coming into your eye to tell you that they're green or not, you know that they're green. On the other hand, if you turn your head and suddenly see a tree, there's a moment where you haven't realized it's a tree yet, and it's sufficiently dark outside that you don't have any information to tell you that it's green, and you will see it as gray. But only for a split second, because as soon as you realize it's a tree, it's green. This, by the way, is a great experiment to do if you can manage it. It's not so easy to do anymore, because you have to find a place that's really dark, right? And you kind of have to surprise yourself. You know, surprise yourself is kind of a non sequitur, right? It's not clear, it's like tickle yourself, right? So, but it's great. If you can manage it, it's great. Because it is a vivid demonstration of many really interesting things, the most important of which is that what you experience of the visual world is not what comes into your eyes. It's what you interpret. It's the interpretation that you make out of what comes into your eyes. Just like our friends in Geneva, who are doing this incredibly complicated experiment at the Large Hadron Collider, what they see when they tell you that, when hopefully they tell us that they've discovered X, it's not because they saw X. They did a complicated experiment, they collected a lot of data, and the best interpretation is that there was an X, whatever the X is, it's a Higgs particle, supersymmetric particle, or whatever. Okay? So in the same way that when you do a scientific experiment, you very seldom get to literally see the thing that you were looking for. When you perceive the world, in a very deep sense, you also don't get to see the thing you were looking for. You get some data, and you literally make sense out of it. Now, most insects don't have separate rods and cones. When I told you that I was making the physicist's approximation that there's one cell behind every one of these lenses, if you're a fly, there are eight cells. Six of them are identical and provide no color information. And if you want, they're like the rods. There are two that have some color sensitivity, and but they're not. They don't operate at a different at different intensities the way ours do. So they don't separate night and day. When it gets too dark, flies stop flying. Okay. So there are all these marvelous optical tricks that insects use to build better eyes and to focus light and so on. But the reason I wanted to bring this up was to say, okay, well, this is great. You know, if I'm a physicist and I remember the right part of my education, I can understand something about how this all works. But, you know, in physics, we've gotten used to doing something that's a little more ambitious than just understanding how it happens to work. There are lots of areas of physics where we have theories that are so compelling that you sort of feel like it had to be that way. You know, we have descriptions of parts of nature that are so beautiful that you think, yeah, you know, that's the way it ought to be. And that's, of course, a very dangerous thing to think. But there are those moments where you feel like, yeah, you know, it all hangs together in such a compelling way that it's not just that if you show me this particular thing, I can explain it to you. It's really, I could tell you in advance that it's going to be like this. So is it possible that in something this complicated, I could tell you in advance that it should look like this? Well, let's think about what problem it is that the fly has. He's trying to see. And what are the things you can play with? Well, let's assume you're going to use this strategy of making lots of little lenses. How should you do it? Well, you might think that what you're basically doing is dividing the world up into pixels, just like in your digital camera. And it's even more obvious because you have one lens for every pixel. Now, you all know that you pay more for more pixels. So maybe the fly feels the same way, and she would like more pixels. So maybe the thing to do is to make these lenses smaller. So let's think about what that means. Why do you want to do that? So here's the size of the lens. And let me it's called size D. And you know, there's that joke about the prosperous businessman who sends his son off to study physics and figures out that, you know, this ought to be good for something, and figures, you know, this is about things moving, all that stuff. So, you know, maybe he would understand something about horse racing, and, you know, that would actually be useful. And so he sets his son this problem of, you know, learning to predict the outcome of horse races. That goes off, and he's working on it, he sends his dad back. And eventually, you know, he finally comes to his son and said, look, you know, tuition at MIT is really expensive. You know, we want some results here. How's it going? And he says, well, I've worked out the case of the spherical horse. And this, of course, is a comment on the physicist's penchant for simplifying assumptions, even sometimes to the point of absurdity. So let us consider the case where your head is spherical and it has some radius r. So what does that mean? It means that if you make a little pixel of size d, then there is an angle, right? And this angle is the size of the lens, the linear size of the lens in inches, divided by this radius. So, you know, there's 360 degrees around the circle. So if you made 360 lenses, then each of them would be 1 degree wide. And if you think about it, that corresponds to making, you know, that's the ratio of this size to that size. Right? If you want to make 360 of them all the way around, and you make the head twice as big, then you have to make the lenses twice as big. So the angular size of the pixels is proportional to the size of the lens. Goes something like this. And so if you operate down here, it seems great, because you've divided the world up into little tiny pixels, so you can see all the details. And if you operate out here, it's not so good, because you've broken the world into these great big blobby pixels. And, you know, you look out at the world like this, and, you know, there's a blob over there that has four people in it. There's a blob over there that has four people in it. You can't see any detail at all. Okay. So you might say, all right, I know what should happen. There must be some evolutionary pressure to build better visual systems, to see more details. And so that's going to drive insects down this line. And what I should see out in the world are insects that have little tiny lenses. and you don't. And so, well, you know, biology is complicated. But that's actually, it's because you got the physics wrong. If you go back to your bathtub, and instead of taking your finger like this, let's take a plate, shake it up and down like this, so you launch a wave. And that wave goes like this, and it's moving this way. Right. And you then put a barrier to the wave. And the barrier has a small hole. But what happens? If I make a really small hole, well, first of all, mostly nothing happens on this side because it's a small hole. But importantly, whatever does get through radiates outward. The wave gets bent by the hole. This is called diffraction. And what that means is that, well, another way of thinking about it is that if there were a source out here, it could find its way in. And if there were a source right here, it could find its way in. By making a very small hole, given that what you have to work with are waves, you've completely destroyed your sense of directionality. So the technical way of saying this is that if you look through smaller and smaller holes, your view of the world gets blurrier and blurrier. And so there's a, because of diffraction, if you try to build little tiny lenses, then instead of this cell looking out through this lens and seeing a very small region, it will look out through this lens and see a very broad region, just like the effect here. Right? So imagine putting the receptor cell sitting here. You might think that since it's sitting in front of this little hole, it only looks this way. But that's not true. It's going to end up looking in all these directions. And so actually, you'll have lots of little tiny pixels, each of which gets a blurry view of the entire picture. And that doesn't do you any good at all. So there's another curve to be drawn here. Which says that there's a diffraction blur. Solid line. So if I make little tiny pixels, I've got lots of them, but they're very blurry. If I make really big pixels, then they can focus very tightly, but of course there's only a few of them, and so I don't get a very good image. The best you can do, oh, and by the way, this line has a slope. This line is an angle which is the size of the lens divided by the radius of your head, roughly speaking. And this line, it goes the other way. Your resolution gets better the bigger the lens is, but what matters is the wavelength of light. So what this tells you is that there's some sweet spot in here, which is where the size of the lens is something like the product of the wavelength of the light times the size of your head, and then you take the square root. So maybe you never thought you'd have to go to a lecture with square roots in it again. But there you are. That's the answer. That because of the physics, what you really want to do is to build lenses whose size scales with the size of your head, but not linearly with the size of your head, as the square root of the size of your head. Now, this has a remarkable history to it. So by the way, this is an astonishing claim, right? It says that if I go out and look at insects, which of course come in all different sizes, I can predict how big the lenses of their eyes should be, just by thinking about the physics that's involved in building a good imaging system. Now it turns out that this is not a new idea. So right? The great American physicist Richard Feynman gave a series of undergraduate lectures on physics in the early 1960s. The course of lectures has been a sort of Bible for physics students ever since. If you look through that, you will find that there is a chapter about vision. And if you look in that chapter, you will find this calculation. And you will find that he plugged in the numbers and noticed that you get the right answer to within 10% for B. Not bad. That was 1963. What Feynman didn't know was that in 1952, well actually, in 1895, a guy named Malick, now 1895, the idea that, you know, light is a wave and we understand optics, I mean, that wasn't very old. So, I mean, it's been around for a while, but, you know, for example, the theory of how microscopes work was about then. So this guy Malick realized that the difference between us, who have these nice big lenses, and insects with little tiny lenses, was this problem. And by the way, we do about this well too. That is to say, our angular resolution is related to the size of the lens by the usual diffraction thing, right? You might say, well, you know, by building a nice big lens, you sort of get rid of this problem. So why don't insects do that? And the answer, it's a slightly upsetting image, but you should realize that the size of the typical insect is the empty space inside your eyeball, right? So this is a solution which works if you're big and you can afford to waste all this space. If you're small, like an insect, there's no wasted space in here. In fact, the fly's brain is sitting right here, right? So it's a different solution. But given that you adopt this kind of solution, there's clearly something you should do, which is you should scale this funny business with the square root. So, 1952, Horace Barlow was a remarkable character, done all sorts of things related to vision. He's also the grandson of Charles Darwin, you know. Great-grandson. He goes into the museum, the Zoology Museum in Cambridge, and starts rifling through the doors and looks at a whole bunch of insects and carefully measures different species of insects, carefully measures the size of their head and the size of their lenses. And lo and behold, the size of the lenses is proportional to the square root of the size of the head. And this is true over a range of nearly a factor of 100 in head sizes. So, by the way, this isn't the whole story. If you really want this to work, you should only take insects that fly around in the daytime. Because, of course, if it's dark outside, then there's another term here, right, that I've left out of the story, which is that if I make my pixels really, really small, I don't collect very much light. And now I won't see very well, not because my images are blurry, but because they're grainy. Right? It's like in the old days of real photography, you know, with the silver grains, right? You know, there's the smallest thing you can detect, which is related to the size of the grains, right? So you don't want to go too far if there's not enough light. If there's plenty of light, then there's no problem. So if you're a big, slow insect flying in the noonday sun, you should do this. And if you're one of those little annoying guys that flies around just after dusk, then you should make your lenses a little bigger. Right, open up the aperture a bit. Okay? And that's true too, that works. It's a little less clear that there's a quantitative theory for it, but it works. Why have I told you this story? It's because it's an example, an old example, of taking the diversity of life, right? There's all these different insects, they've got different sized heads, they've got different sized lenses, and then you realize underneath all that, there's something that brings order, right? Insects have a problem to solve. They have to be able to see. Physics tells you that they're seeing better and they're seeing worse, right? And presumably, there's been evolutionary pressure to see better. And if that pressure has acted long enough and is strong enough, then organisms will get pushed to the limit, to the point where they can't do any better. And if they do that, then all of that diversity of different sized heads and different sized lenses will collapse onto a simple relationship. And that's what you actually see in nature.
A question?
Yes.
There's a lambda in that formula. Did they optimize for
particular lambda? So this is also a little bit of hand waving, because of course you don't only see one wavelength of light, right? You see a range. Now, that range isn't that big, and the range, you know, it's a factor of two, and the range is pretty much the same for all the insects. So you could say, well, I can do much better if I make lambda smaller, right? I know that I can build a higher resolution camera by looking at shorter and shorter wavelengths. Shorter wavelength light corresponds to higher energy photons. And if I make the photons have too high energy, then when I absorb them, I'll break chemical bonds. And you don't want to do that. In fact, you'll release free radicals. All sorts of terrible stuff happens. In fact, you have to do some work to make sure that you don't expose yourself to those very high energies. Also, those very high energies are largely absorbed by water. There's a beautiful figure in that textbook that we all studied out of in order to learn all this stuff about waves, Dave Jackson's Classical Electrodynamics. There's this amazing figure that he put together, which shows the absorption of light by water. And not just light, everything from the far infrared out into the X-rays. Okay, the entire electromagnetic spectrum. Orders of magnitude of variation in wavelength or the energy of the photon. And what you see is that everything gets absorbed. Okay. If the wavelengths are really, really long, they're being absorbed by the water molecules vibrating or rotating. If the wavelengths are very, very short, they're being absorbed by exciting the electrons deep inside the oxygen atoms. And there's a little window in this many, many orders of magnitude of wavelengths that are available to us that the sun is raining down on us all the time. There's a little window that's about a factor of two wide. And that's where all the interaction of biology with light happens. That's that little window in which we see. It's the little window in which plants photosynthesize. That's it. Okay. Given to us by the physical properties of the medium that we live in. So there really isn't too much freedom here. Beautiful, beautiful demonstration of how we're constrained by our physical world. So, yes?
You've described two scenarios or strategies that nature's used for sight. One
big lens versus, yeah.
Are there others? Fish or birds or something else?
So, there are variations on these two themes.
But these are the themes.
So, for example, the so-called simple eye, but these are called simple eyes or camera eyes. These are called compound eyes. I think the compound is sort of obvious, simple. Seems sort of pejorative, I'm not sure we got that. Well, it's the one case in which we're in the simple category, so maybe we should celebrate that rather than, I don't know. So what is interesting is that, right, this has been discovered by evolution more than once. So octopus, for example, have a simple eye, but that's not because of our common ancestor, right? Okay, so that's interesting. Now, there's another problem, which is that, again, you know, I can get higher and higher resolution, be able to see smaller and smaller features by making the lens bigger and bigger. This is why our astronomer friends are up on top of the mountain trying to build 30-meter telescopes. Okay, so we have a couple of millimeters to work with, maybe a centimeter, but same idea, right? So why don't I keep making this thing bigger and bigger? You know, at some point I've got a problem, I can't make it any bigger. What can I do? Well, remember that I can also try to change the relationship between distance on the retina and angle and hope that I could get a little bit more out of this. And the way you would do this is by taking the retina and folding it into a pit so that many cells sort of oversample the range that you can resolve through the lens. And that's what birds like eagles do, and falcons, that have this extraordinary ability to resolve detail on the ground while they're 1,000 feet up in the air.
So
Doesn't predator or prey have a...
Predator or prey, that's mostly where you put your eyes, right? So we have our eyes in front, predators this way. And if you're an insect, well, you do a little bit of both, depends on what kind of insect you are. And as I say, they sort of have these wraparound eyes, which is quite extraordinary. They're literally eyes in the back of their head. Eyes plural, right? Because you think of many lenses. Yeah. So this is an example of how there really are physical principles that you can appeal to that allow you to bring order to the variations that you see in a diversity of organisms. I mean, insects are a pretty varied lot. You can make sense out of at least parts of it. Let me, this has taken a little longer than I thought it would, as always. You'd think that by now I would learn to correct. Let me make a couple more observations about this, and then let me tell you one short piece that is very different, but has a similar spirit, that there's something underneath that's about how the system manages to sort of perform as well as it can in the presence of physical limits. Let me, just to give you a feeling, right, I've talked about this in a way that emphasizes the simplicity in the physics. So let me uncover for you the incredible complexity of the biology and then tell you that there's order to that too. So what actually happens in these cells when they absorb light? Well, or in these cells for that matter, in your retina. It's a little different in insects than in us, but in outline, the idea is the same. The signals that your brain understands are electrical signals. When one cell talks to another in the brain, they make electrical pulses at the point where one cell touches another that gets converted into a chemical signal, which is then retranslated back into an electrical signal by the next cell. So what these cells must be doing is absorbing light and generating an electrical signal in response. Now, the process by which that happens is very complicated. Okay, so there's the molecule that absorbs the light. When it absorbs the light, it changes its structure. That triggers a sequence of chemical reactions. And then somehow at the end of that, an electrical current flows. Well, a cell let's do the case in us. A cell, so this is one of these rod cells in our retina. And stacked up in here are all the molecules that are going to absorb the light. So if you look at this thing end on, it's black because it absorbs all the light. And actually, if you look from this side, it's particularly black. But if you look this way, it's pretty dark too. And like all cells, there's a membrane that goes around the cell that defines what's inside and what's outside. And the first thing that cells have to do is sort of take control of their environment. They have to make sure that molecules that they care about, I mean, these are living things, right? They need sugars, and they need calcium, and they need all this stuff, right? And it has to not float away. And, you know, a lot of work goes into concentrating all those nutrients in the right place. So what defines a cell is that there is an impermeable boundary called the cell membrane. And it is impermeable to stuff, like sugar, but it's also impermeable to electrical current. Remember, I told you there's no metallic coatings anywhere, right? So if you want to make an electrical signal in biology, there are no wires. All there are insulators. So how do you ever make an electrical signal? The way you make an electrical signal is that into the cell membrane are inserted little molecules, which are proteins. And these molecules have holes that go through them. And the hole is the diameter, well, I'll speak a little bit colloquially, it is the diameter of an atom. It's a little bigger than an atom, it's about 3 atoms wide. And it is through that hole that ions, like sodium and potassium and calcium, can flow. And when they flow, that carries an electrical current. And all the electrical currents in your body result from moving ions around in water and moving through these little channels, as they're called, in the cell membrane. And these channels have literally gates on them. And these gates can open and close. Okay, what does this mean? It's a big, complicated molecule, and it can sit like this, and the hole is open, or it can go, and then the hole is closed. Okay? And for example, what happens in the case of the cells in your visual system is that these molecules that are packed in here absorb light. That triggers a change in structure, long series of chemical reactions. And at the output of that series of chemical reactions, there's a molecule that can float around inside here and stick to these channels. And when it sticks to the channel opens. And that's why current flows. Now, so this is already a lot more complicated than this, right? This, we're getting into the territory that David described, any self-respecting physicist just runs away. But we're not there yet, because I haven't told you the most important part, which is that if you look, these are proteins. That means the information to make them is sitting in your DNA, right? Sitting in your genome. So let's look through your genome and look for all the molecules that are channels. There are 130 of them, all different. Furthermore, these are big molecules. They come in pieces. The pieces can be mixed and matched. So not only are there 130 of them to start with, but you can mix and match. You can make hundreds of thousands of different kinds of channels. Ready to give up yet? What's different about them? Well, among others, there's many things different about them. Some of them respond to one molecule binding here, and others respond to binding here. But there's a really important difference. How fast do they open and close? How fast they open and close determines whether, if you snap your fingers inside the cell and suddenly change something, does the current flow immediately, or does it take a little while to build up? Well, let's go back to our friend here, who's flying along. And let's assume he's flying this way, up. If you think about it, there's a lens over here, and a cell underneath it that's looking straight ahead. And if you think about it, I mean, we're not flying, but the principle is the same. Remember, they can't move their eyes. So think about the point that you're looking straight ahead, right? And you walk, the signal at that point where you're looking isn't changing very much, right? There's a gray spot on the wall. It stays a gray spot on the wall. On the other hand, as I'm walking, what I'm seeing over here is changing a lot because I'm passing all these people. Now, this is an even bigger effect if you're a fly, because his eyes go out to here, right? And remember, a fly is flying at a meter per second. It's not strolling along like we do. So the signals that are coming into the fly's eye straight ahead are completely different than the signals that are coming in on the side. The signals that are coming in from straight ahead are sort of slow, gradual. Over here, things are literally flying by, right? They're changing really, really fast. And so what does it turn out? Turns out that the fly looks through his genome, and he finds a channel that's slow, and that's the one he puts over here. And he shuffles through the genome some more until he finds a channel that's faster, and those are the ones he puts over here. Now, we can't do, so the words that I just said don't yet translate into equations that are precise enough that you can say exactly how everything's going to work. But there are attempts to do that. and attempts to understand how the organism can make use of all this incredible complexity to, at the very beginning of collecting data about the visual world, be more efficient, right? So you want to collect data out here with a camera that's very fast, and out here you want to use a camera that's slower. It's always better to use a camera that's slower, right? You all know when you're taking a picture, you want your exposure time to be as long as it can be, because then you collect as much light as possible, you get as good, sharp an image as possible. But if things are changing very fast, you can't do that. So what the fly has been able to do by using all of this complexity that's hiding in its genome, not quite as much as ours, but it's a lot, is to do the equivalent of having a fast shutter speed looking this way and a slow shutter speed looking that way. So maybe we can even reach into the complexity of the genome and see something about why, in terms of the physics of the problem that the organism is trying to solve, she chooses to do things the way she does. So this is all very classical, and it's about vision, and it's about really a very small fraction of the organisms on the planet. Insects, us, you know, we're a pretty big perturbation to the planet, but most of the organisms on the planet aren't anything like us. In fact, most of the organisms in the room aren't anything like us. Most of the organisms in the room are bacteria. Right? Because every one of us is carrying around as many bacteria as there are people on the planet. So if you really, something to think about, perhaps even over dinner. And so if you really want to think about life, you should think every once in a while about life in the large, which is to say bacteria. So there's another beautiful example, and this is where I'll end. I promise. Takes 10 minutes at most. So bacteria, they've got a completely different set of problems than we do, or than our friend the fly over there does. A lot of their problems stem from the fact that they're just so damn small. So bacteria like E. coli, the things that live in our gut for part of their life, I'll let you think about where they live the rest of the time. They're very small. They're less than a thousandth of an inch in size. And they have, their problems in life are really wrapped up in the physics of their world. Their biggest problem is just getting around. Because there's a very basic principle a very basic consequence of the equations of fluid mechanics, which is that if you look at the equations for motion in a fluid, you can trade off the size of the objects, how fast you're moving, and how viscous the fluid is. And what this means is that if we, right, so we, when we go swimming, we're swimming in water. When bacteria are swimming, they're swimming in water. So you might think, well, they're in the same fluid, they have the same problems. But that's not true, because if you look at the equations, what you discover is that changing your size is just like changing your viscosity of the fluid around you. So if what we wanted to do was to have the same experience that a bacterium does, we would have to change the viscosity of the swimming pool so that it scales back to what it is for the size of the bacterium. And the way to do that would be to fill the swimming pool with concrete just before it sets. That's how viscous it looks if you're a micron in size. So you can imagine that these creatures have all sorts of physics-driven problems just moving around. But they have another problem, and so I'm not going to talk about that one, which is a wonderful one. They have another problem, which is that they have to decide where to go. Now, they are so small, so first of all, they can't see. Well, most of them can. There are bacteria that can see, that is to say, they have little eye spots, and they can swim up toward the light. It's pretty cute. By the way, the molecules that they use look almost exactly like the molecules that we use that are sitting in here. So this is a spectacular example of evolutionary conservation. But mostly bacteria, you know, they'd like to eat. And so they'd like to swim, for example, to a source of sugar. So how do they figure out where the sugar is? Well, you could say, but if you're sitting here, why don't you sniff a little bit and see how much sugar is over here and how much sugar is over there. And if there's lots over here, you should go that way. And that sounds like a great idea until you actually think of the physics of what's happening with all those sugar molecules. Turns out the sugar molecules are moving around in the water at random. So what's actually happening on the scale where bacteria actually live is that they are seeing a relatively small number of molecules. Let's see. Maybe colors would help. So they're seeing a relatively small number of molecules. And these molecules are moving around at random. And so if they just tried to count how many molecules they see on this side of their body and how many molecules they see on that side of the body, well, the two numbers would be different. But mostly they'd be different because the molecules are moving around at random, not because there's more sugar in front of them than behind them. And in fact, bacteria are too small. So of course you could get around this, right? You could sort of stay there for a really long time and count lots and lots of molecules, but you know, by then somebody else would eat you. So there's just no way that they can measure, they can figure out which way to go by doing this relative counting in space. So what they do instead is as they move along, they keep a running count. And if the running count is going up, then it must be because things are getting better and they're seeing more molecules. And if the running count is going down, they must be going in the wrong direction. So if you think about it, and it turns out that if they do that, then you can make it work. And so what is this like? It's like you're standing on the street corner and you would like to know, has the population of my neighborhood gone up? And you watch the people milling around. Now obviously, if the people walk faster, you'll see more of them, it'll be easier. So how fast are the people walking? Well, how fast are the molecules moving? That's called the diffusion constant of the molecules. If instead of only looking at the people who cross your path, you could sort of agree with a whole bunch of friends to look at a bigger area, then you'd do better, right? So there's the size of the bacterium. And then there's how long you're willing to count. Obviously, if you count all day, right? You do get a better estimate, but that's too long. So, and actually, if you're a bacterium, the real reason you can't count too long is not that somebody's going to eat you, it's that you yourself will start to move around at random because you're so small. And so if you think you're going this way, after a while you're not going that way anymore, and that only takes about 15 seconds. Okay? Because they're so small, they can't actually drive themselves forward. So it turns out that if, you know, you can't count for more than 15 seconds because then you're not going in the direction you thought you were going in, you have to count for at least 3 or 4 seconds in order to get this number up high enough that you can reliably tell that there's something different this way than that way. And then you could say, well, at that point, maybe you could see a sort of, you've counted enough molecules that you can see about a 1% difference over a range about this big. And that's about how well these bacteria can do. So, and actually what you can then do is to reach inside the bacterium and say, well, can I really see that he's counting and adding, sort of accumulating for a few seconds and then taking a difference between what happened in those few seconds and the few seconds before? And you can unravel all of the biochemical machinery inside that's actually doing those computations. And so it's, a remarkable example of how there's a real problem the animal has to solve in order to survive in the world. Evolution has pushed these organisms to the point where they're solving it about as well as you can given their physical constraints. And if that's true, then there are some aspects of how they do it that they really have to get right. They've got to get these timescales right. And then you go in and look, and indeed, they've gotten them right. And we can see molecularly exactly what's responsible for doing it. So what I hope to have convinced you of with these two very different examples is that although biology has all these rich phenomena, there's some order. Okay. Now, of course, I've given you a tour that emphasizes the order, and I've picked my examples carefully. But what many of us are excited about is that over a 25-year period, these examples have accumulated. And at some point, you start to wonder whether they connect and whether there is the outlines of something. After all, the problem of forming the best image that you can is really a problem of extracting as much information as you can from the visual world. And the problem of measuring whether the concentration is going up or down is, again, a problem about extracting as much information as you can. These are really the same problem. They look very different. The details of what's pushing the system around are very different. But underneath, these are problems about measuring things about the physical world and extracting information from the data that you can collect. And an awful lot of biology is about that. Right now, we have a program going on here about the dynamics of development in embryos. So an animal lays an egg, and out of a seemingly homogeneous mass comes a completely differentiated organism. Somehow, this end of the animal has to know to become the head. This end of the animal has to know to become the tail. There are signals inside the embryo, just like there are signals raining down on the retina, and there are signals, more literally, raining down on the bacterium that are telling those cells, become part of the head, become part of the tail. And if you want to build a complex organism and you want to do it reliably so it comes out right every time, you have to get as much information as you can out of those signals, just like the fly, just like the bacterium. And so the kinds of problems that many of us are interested in revolve around these issues of information flow and the physical limits to that information. And we're hoping that these ideas, that the examples of which go back now quite some time, are going to connect up to give us a theory of how these very diverse and really very beautiful systems function as efficiently and dramatically as they do. So, thanks very much.
There's always time for some burning questions.
Please.
So you talked about the, you know, the bacteria keeping a running average of the number of sugar molecules in a certain direction. So thinking of this as a control engineer, I think this is this is a feedback loop with integral gain.
Yeah.
And so I guess my...
Do you know more about this than you're letting on, or go ahead? Okay. You got that from what I said? Oh, that's great. I have no idea I'm actually going to get that much. Go ahead. Sorry, go on.
So, you can think of other biological examples of where the same mechanism is being used. For example, our temperature regulation.
Yes, yes.
So my question is, do we know what the earliest example of this, feedback loop is? And then you talk about conservation in evolution. How prevalently is that used, and how is it being used?
So there's a lot going on in the question. And it's evocative of many different things. So the part that really had the sort of hidden relation to control theory that I was kind of joking about is that, of course, this guy has another problem, which is he has to measure whether things are getting better. Doesn't do him any good to measure whether things are good, right? Because he's measuring across time. So the confusion between whether things are getting better and whether they're good in an absolute sense, this is a problem that has larger ramifications than just for the bacterium, right? As I'm sure you realize. But for bacteria, it's really very serious. because a little bit of confusion of good for getting better can completely screw him up. And so he really has to compare now with the past. And if these two numbers are the same, they really have to subtract to give him zero. And so he has a problem of, I mean, the only way to do this is with a sort of integral controller that allows you to actually get zero quite accurately. In fact, there are measurements to show that really is quite accurate. And that's a whole field, which, by the way, is a problem that was emphasized first by physicists in this context. So there are a lot of situations, for example, when you tie your shoes in the morning. Yes, okay, there are still some people who wear shoes that have laces. You tie your shoes in the morning, right? You feel it when you pull the thing tight, right? And then you walk around for a while and you don't. Now, this isn't a controlled experiment, so it could be that your shoes are getting looser. But it's also true that if I do this, after a while, I don't notice anymore that there's a force on my hand, right? So there are a lot of situations in biology where there's a constant and you manage to subtract that off quite accurately. And so in this context was the first place that people emphasized that that's really a very serious problem, and that the standard way of going at that, which is to say, well, you've got one signal that's a sort of positive signal that says, well, there's the force, and you have another signal that says, oh, it's been going on for a while, let's subtract. That really doesn't work, because then you're basically, you really are subtracting two big numbers and hoping that they'll come out the same. You really want to do it in this feedback way. Anyway, so that's part of your question sort of has something to do with that problem. Now, what you were really asking was, is there a kind of example of this? And there's a very... So physicists love the simplest example of everything. And often it's a challenge to find what that is. And in biology, it's a really serious challenge. First of all, there's a sense in which, you know, I spent a lot of my time interested in things about how the brain works. You know, what's the simplest example of a working brain? Sort of putting simple and brain in the same sentence already is problematic, right? By the time it's simple enough to call it the simplest example, you might, well, yeah, but that's not an example anymore, right? So in seriousness, the real problem is that all the organisms you see today are, of course, the end product or the current state of evolution. We don't actually see the primordial examples. They're gone. So what we know, for example, is that there are bacteria that can see. They're incredibly sensitive. They're, in fact, about as sensitive as our rod cells in that when one quantum of light is absorbed, they will respond reliably. And the molecules that they use look an awful lot like the molecules that we use. So there are some of these things where, you know, you look today at things whose last common ancestor was hundreds of millions of years ago, and they look pretty much the same. In fact, these mechanisms are so strongly conserved that you can use that fact to discover things. So in your rod cells, you have a molecule that absorbs light, changes its structure, and signals, triggers a cascade of events that eventually produces an electrical signal. For many years, people were curious, well, what is the corresponding thing that happens in your nose? Presumably, there's a receptor. A molecule binds to it when you sniff, and something happens inside the cell. Right? And so what people decided to do was to say, well, let me make the guess that whatever those molecules are, they work with the same kind of biochemical amplifier, the same kind of molecular amplifier that the cells in your visual system do. And let's use that strategy to search through your genome, well, that's not exactly how they did it in those days, for molecules that could be this kind of interface to this molecular amplifier. Well, and that worked so well that David had a chance to meet them in Stockholm in 2004. So really, the sort of conservation is so strong that the question of, you know, can I see the simplest one? They're all, in many cases, it almost feels like they're all the simplest one plus elaborations. Right? It's the basic mechanisms are always the same. Yes.
I have a simple question. Clearly. You're discussing some very beautiful
products of evolution as these things.
Yes.
But being a physicist, I'm sure that you go back in time, just as Dr. Gross wants to do. If you went back to the Big Bang of evolution, do you or your colleagues look at, if you start with that periodic table and the hydrocarbons, amino acids, and then to proteins and nucleic acids and fatty acids, what is this? I know they can't do different two-body to three-body.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, you can't.
But are there statistical or other methods that are done to say, in the limited 4 billion or so years we got, can all this actually happen?
Okay, so there's two directions for the answer. One, which is really important, okay, in a community of educated lay people who care a lot about science, it is really important to understand that that we cannot do a kind of rough calculation like the thing I did over here to tell you why it was possible in 4 billion years to have life happen. That calculation we can't do. Personally, I think that if we could explain to people that we can't do that, and that doesn't have anything to do with why we think evolution is true, right? The whole debate in the public sphere would be a little different. Okay? There is no question that that you can observe evolutionary change. Whether we can figure out how to get from the evolutionary changes that it's been possible for us to observe to extrapolate the 4 billion years, that's a really hard problem. I mean, in some ways, we're spoiled by the tremendous success of theoretical physics, right? The physics that we can observe in the laboratory extrapolates to the scale of the universe. But that's an amazing triumph. It took 4 centuries, right? Or, I mean, it depends on where you start counting. But there's a clear argument that it took 4 centuries, okay? We could discuss before Galileo, but...
4 billion.
There had to be people around to talk about it, which, as you know, is one of the ideas about why the universe looks the way it does. But anyhow. So, we can't do that calculation. So I have no idea. That's the end of the answer to that question, right? I could keep talking, but okay. So but you asked another question, which has to do with, you know, if I look at the sort of chemical ingredients for life, can I get anywhere by thinking about the reactions that are possible and things like this? And this people really do work on. So you look at, you know, there's this amazing chart of all the biochemical reactions that happen inside a cell, and you could point to something in there, and you could say, well, why that molecule instead of, I mean, look, you know, the sugar that you eat from the outside world, you know why you eat that. It's because it's there, right? So you should eat the thing that's there. But inside, you know, you start with this molecule, and you go to that molecule, and you go through all these things. Why this one? So there are people who are asking, well, let me go to my general knowledge of organic chemistry. Let me look at all the molecules that are about that complicated. And let me ask, well, is there anything special about the choice of this one and this one relative to all the other possibilities? My understanding is that this isn't something that's gotten to the point of being a predictive theory yet. But people are, you know, it's the kind of question people are trying to ask. So the second half of your question, I think the answer is people are trying. The first half is nobody knows, nobody has the slightest idea.
On that optimistic note.